things that can't be explained, either are extraterrestrial spacecraft, if that's what you mean.
Why don't you believe that?
Well,
a moment ago you used a cop-out, you weren't quite sure of anything, and now you became an authority in the last 7 seconds.
Oh, no, I'm telling us
that they're not.
I'm only an authority in the sense that I have spent the last, I would say, 8 months checking through the files of Project Blue Book, which is our government's official UFO unidentified file.
Are you an American citizen?
You know, sometimes I doubt that when you look at me that way.
I was just wondering, are you proud of that book that you just used for your reference?
The Project Blue Book? Of course I'm proud of it.
Why?
I think the United States Air Force is doing a great job.
Really?
Yes, really.
Well, tell me more about it. I'll give you another 2 seconds to give me all the knowledge
two
that
seconds?
You have about
well,
this.
Well, they opened their files to me, and they'd open it to any accredited member of the press.
Fine. That's true. I'm aware of that, too. But when you say open their files, what does it mean?
It means they have 11,000 odd cases there, and if you want to spend the time, you can go through.
How about 659 that they know nothing about? What is
now,
what information
of those,
do you have on those?
Of those 659, by the way, there are only 65 that have enough data slide to give you an opinion that they can't be solved. The rest.
All right.
No way,
I'll take the 65 then. Don't bother with the other 600. Throw those out. Now let's get down to 65.
Right.
What do you know about those?
Well, they're all listed in those issues of Science and Mechanics.
Well, I know. I hope you.
And I know that this
TV
one.
We'll let the people read these magazines tonight.
The one thing that struck me, the one thing that was very unique to me, was that of those 65 cases, almost all of them, with enough data and by reliable observers, of the total, there were less than three each that jived with the rest.
What does that mean?
That means that the unidentified flying objects that were observed by these individuals were completely different in shape, I mean in configuration, in action, in color, in all kinds of things, you know, all of the, in their tactics, in their velocities. These things all contradicted each other. Now, if this
well,
is
if there's 65, there would be room for contradiction, wouldn't it? This is not a choral group that you're talking about.
No, but my point is, John, my point is that if there were an intelligent super race on some planet around some nearer star sending these spacecraft into the Earth to keep us under surveillance, why would they need, say, 58 to 60 different configurations and different types of spacecraft?
I don't know.
They were intelligent,
you're the man who writes all these articles, so I only had you here because you were an expert. I didn't ask you to come up here and wax the floors, did I?
No, but you're questioning that I'm an expert.
You mean you doubt your expertise?
No, I don't. You do.
Well, I must say, the fact is that you tell me that there's 65, and already you told me that they can't be coming from some other planet.
I told you
have
you
no
why. I told you that it seems unlikely that of 65 that are absolutely unknown, the Air Force, our government cannot really identify, and yet there is enough information for them to make an identification, if that's possible. Of these 65, there are 58 to 60 of them that are completely different, that don't match. So this means there has to be at least 58 to 60 different races of extraterrestrial people keeping us under surveillance, or else it means that one race somewhere out there in the universe has designed 58 to 60 different types of spacecraft, which is very inefficient.
Well, aren't you the same man that knows that the Russians, that their Sputnik?
No, not their Sputnik.
No.
Not their Cosmos.
You don't even know what I'm going to ask you about.
Well, I'm sure.
I wanted to ask you what you thought of their knit ties.
I'll tell you something. They don't wear knit ties.
out here tonight.
I never saw this high in the Soviet Union.
Well, I don't, then I won't ask you that question. I'll ask you another question. Let's get back to what were you telling us in your series of articles in Science and Mechanics? You considered the whole Russian space program to be, you know, fraudulent.
No, I didn't say that. I considered their entire manned space program a fake.
It's a fake.
Yeah.
Right. And how did you learn this, Mr. Mallon?
I learned it the hard way. First of all, before I went over there.
Everything you do is the hard way, but keep going.
And you make it harder.
That's how I realize it. Keep going.
No, before I went over there, I believed everything I read in the New York Times or Aviation Week or even in aeronautics and astronautics.
Or even Science and Mechanics.
That's right. I believed this, and then I went over there on an assignment, and I received one shock after another. I mean, their electronic equipment, by the way.
Oh, I thought you were going to speak of the Russian girl's ankles. They are a little thick.
Well, that's true, except, and they aren't very pretty. That's another bit of propaganda. There are a few who are, only a few.
Do you enjoy expertise in that area, too, Mr.
No, this is just a side.
Let's stick in the things that you really are an expert.
All right.
Smoking can do you no harm.
I didn't say
UFOs,
that.
What did you say?
I said smoking can be safer. That's what the theme of my book is.
The title
was not my fault. The publisher...
Said, what is the title, sir?
The title is, It Is Safe to Smoke.
Good. All right, sir, continue.
That is not my title.
Who is it, the American Tobacco Company?
No, I didn't... Look, I have no connection with any tobacco company. I guarantee you that.
No, I was only asking about the title.
Well, it's Fred Turner's title. He's president of Hawthorne Books.
Fred thought of a good title. He's giving you a lot of... action on that.
He also made me a lot of enemies among the scientists I interviewed, if you want to know the truth.
Because of the title?
Yeah, not because of the book. They all thought it was a good book. But
the title
really annoyed them.
Let me ask Mr.
Well, we didn't finish.
No, I know. I'm going to get back to you in a moment because already you're going to be talking about girls, and I know you don't know much about that.
Oh,
electronics. Let me for a moment ask you, Mr. Stan, you've seen the blue book.
Yes.
Are you impressed with it?
Not very much, no. Some of the material is good, some is bad, some is miserable, frankly. There have been so many changes of policy during the course of the Blue Book program that this is inevitable. In fact, if you go back as far as Ruppelt's original book, when he was shortly after he had left command of the program himself. He acknowledges this in his own writing, which I think is probably the most detailed that is available now on the early history of Blue Book. He points out, for instance, that there was a time when about 10% of the cases actually being called to the Air Force's attention were actually being put down in the Blue Book program. They simply weren't able to cope with the rest of them. And this was not by any means for a week. Went on for months that a great deal of the material wasn't recorded at all, and when the policy was to favor the idea that there was something important here that should be investigated, a lot of work got done, and it would be a time when somebody up above poo-pooed the whole program, or would be played down to where they were practically doing nothing but shuffle papers.
So I don't have
too much confidence in the Blue Book material.
But how about the people on Blue Book? This is what I was referring to.
They're all nice guys.
No, they're also pretty sharp guys. They try their best. They're
all. If they try their best, then I wouldn't doubt that they are trying their best.
They're not hiding anything from the American public.
How do you know?
That's what I mean.
How do you know?
Well, I know them.
Well, what do you mean that you know them?
I doubt that.
That doesn't mean that you know.
You mean...
Why are they spending $300,000 with, what's his name?
The University of Condon.
Condon's University of Condon.
$350,000, roughly. And why are they doing this?
No.
For this very reason. The public thinks they're hiding something. They turned over the project to Condon at the University of Colorado, and he has a completely free hand. He can release
Well, that's not quite accurate. They didn't turn over the project.
No.
The Project Blue Book is still going on, quite independent.
Okay,
of Condon.
You're right.
Condon is conducting an independent investigation. He's supposed to have access to all the Blue Book material. What much good it'll do him, I think. But it's quite independent of Blue Book, which continues.
Well, yes, except that he has an absolutely free hand and can make his own investigations and can release his decisions or his committee's decisions without even consulting the Air Force.
Incidentally, I have a flash for you on that. I spoke to him day before yesterday, and I'm told, yes, I'm told there will be no release of a public statement for quite a long time, perhaps not until the end of this first phase of this investigation, which may be late 1967.
Well, this is because the guy's a scientist and he's playing it cautiously.
Well, that is what he told me. He said it's simply they're snowed under there with work. In fact, when I called him, I was dumbfounded to find that the first person that spoke to me on the phone was him, which will give you an idea of how heavily staffed they are out there. And he said, frankly, he'd been so pestered by calls and one thing and another that he decided they were going to have to do something else, that they were being just inundated with information and inquiries at this time. They really haven't got very far with it yet.
No, that's true. Not even got underway.
Paris Flamand, what do you think about that? And of course, you did the article in Cavalier magazine. Have you read any of Mr. Mallon's articles?
No, I haven't. That should be an interesting experience. I think that it's even more interesting than the fact that he has articles in the magazine, that he is an expert on the field. I question whether there has ever been an expert on the field of flying saucers or UFOs, which I distinguish one from the other. It seems to me that since the Air Force admits it cannot explain portions of the sightings, has always had 26, 615, there's always a number that it just sloughs off completely.
It's
since,
Let me finish, Mr. Mallon, give you really an opportunity to...
Well, it's his phraseology. Go ahead.
I mean, he can't use those phrases here?
Well, he can.
Moderator now? Come on, Lloyd.
I have maybe a unique idea. Let's let him finish his statement before we rip it
and
apart.
And then you clobber him all you want.
All right.
Go ahead, Mr. Flamand.
After which I'll teach you phraseology. The simple situation is that all of the experts have been people either genuinely curious and collecting what fragments of data are available, trying to put them together into some sort of cohesive intelligence framework, and from that drawing some sort of conclusion. The more intelligent the conclusion, the more tentative the conclusion usually. And so since basically it's a subject about which virtually nothing is really known. There's no hardware, there are no really concrete photographs, there are no good films, there is no data in any really concrete or practical sense. And so it's all speculation. And I hesitate to credit anyone as an expert when the basis of their expertise lies in speculation. I think there are informed people on the subject, and I'm even willing to be convinced that Mr. Mallon is one of those for the evening, but not from what he says so far.
Now, Mr. Mallon.
Touché. Well, I agree with you.
Speaks French.
No, I agree with you.
Had a handicap already.
I agree with you, and this may surprise you.
It ends the argument, I'm afraid.
No, it doesn't end the argument, because by expertise you don't mean this. I mean, I at least don't mean someone who understands what a UFO is, but who understands...
Funny,
I mean, it's a mixture of terms right there. I mean, it argues with itself.
Well, if we go back to that,
I'm sorry,
Tal, but if we go back to that, we can even quarrel about what we mean by an expert, because if you know more about the given subject than anybody else or than most people, then you must almost per se be, comparatively speaking, an expert on a subject, even though you don't know much, if you know more than somebody else.
You had a lot of modifiers in there.
Well, you know anything that doesn't require a few modifiers about this field?
Well, that's my point. To call anyone an expert simply because they know more than someone else. For example, we can have someone who knows a great many of the contactee stories. Knows nothing about the UFOs.
Well, I would say he's an expert on contactee stories. I mean, supposing somebody.
But he wouldn't be an expert on flying saucers.
All right, John would certainly be the man. He's heard more than I have.
Stories I possibly know anybody in the business.
I would buy that. And as a matter of fact,
anything else I don't.
Most people don't even aren't even really familiar with this, and they call themselves experts on UFOs, and they really know nothing about the contactee aspect of it.
Have you ever interviewed a contactee?
Yes.
What was his name?
His name was Noonan, Alan Noonan, out in Los Angeles. In fact, he told me that he even described the architecture of the cities on the planet Venus to me.
Yeah.
Very straightforwardly. He shook me up a little, by the way.
Have you used it tell us some of these things?
Sure,
let me repeat what he told you.
No, I have a tape recording of this.
No, I want you to tell me.
Well, I hope I can remember.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Yes, I love to talk to experts.
Look, let's drop that word, because what I meant when I said I agreed with
Paris. The fact is that Mr. Schatz said that he likes to talk with experts. The fact that now you don't want to be one does not necessarily mean that Flamand and Stanton don't consider themselves experts.
Well, I prefer to
consider him an
expert. I prefer to be an informed person.
All right,
what
informed person.
I agree with her.
I was looking at you, and if I were you, I would have presented my remark too. So I apologize, all right? You're not an expert. But haven't you never apologized on this program?
He always apologizes.
I continually do. Yes, and this is an interesting way of setting people up, if I know
such
what I'm talking
men
about.
Are dangerous, I believe. That's
anyway, to go on. There's a magazine called Flying Saucers, as you all know, put out by Look Magazine. And I think there's a lot of bright people, since Look Magazine, I think, is a fine magazine, and it's made up of bright people. They gathered a lot of bright people together, and they got innumerable pieces of information, like photographs and stories. And they finally, after culling it all, put out this pretty interesting magazine. And after it's all supposedly the best, I would say that they say, well, this is about as good as you can get from this series, and this is about as good as you can get. And finally, we have this in front of us, and we look at it, and it's got a photograph. Pretty as it can be, but
it doesn't say anything.
It simply says we don't agree that there are any flying saucers. And then I looked carefully, being a photographer, I said, well, now I'm going to be, let me be open. Let me be as open as I can. Maybe there was a flying saucer somewhere in here that, you know, but every single photograph in here could easily be tricked. With such ease.
Right.
So that the magazine is interesting, and I looked it over and had lots of fun. I've talked to many of you guys over the years, different flying saucer people, unified UFOs, if you will, people, and always at the end, I get what is a beautiful colored photograph, analogously in my mind, which is faked. That's the feeling I finally get. I'm giving you my character in relation to flying saucers. Now I have these several questions for all of you. I mean, Paris, I know. I've known him for many years, and he and I believe, agree on the situation. UFOs are one thing, flying saucers something else.
That's a very important point, by the way.
Extremely important.
Well, let's see if we can all agree on a definition, then. I would...
A UFO is a thing that has
what
happened...
What it says it is.
That's right, just what it says, unidentified. And a flying saucer is what other people call things that they think they see in the air, from what I feel. Is that pretty good?
Well, if you would put one inside as a part of the other definition, then...
No, I don't know. You can put one near the
other. This, right? UFOs are precisely what they say they are. They are unidentified. Aerial phenomena. Flying saucers are those sightings, or the description applies to those sightings wherein the viewer claims to have observed a craft of any type, size, shape, or description, but a vehicle presumably intelligently controlled, probably extraterrestrial.
I would agree with that. Would you say that was possibly having landed
and people got out?
Yeah.
If
you want to define it that way, I'll go along
with
that.
Would you agree with
that?
I'll
go along with it for the discussion, but I'm sure that's not the the feeling that most of our audience have about what they mean when they
Well, let's try to get...
Flying saucer, but unfortunately, that's the problem. They don't make any distinction between the two. Let us just say that a saucer is, in point of fact, some sort of craft. Otherwise, it's a UFO. And you have to make a distinction between the two if you are going to...
Why did Kenneth Arnold, 20 years ago, when he was interviewed by the press, this Idaho businessman, why didn't, when the reporter said, well, can you describe it, why didn't he say it's unidentified and it was an object? Instead he said, gee, that's pretty tough. It was like a saucer flying through the air. And you know the history of it as well.
I could find out was that he described it as moving like a saucer that you might skip across the water, like we've all thrown flat rocks and skip out. And apparently the reporter or the stringer for AP or somebody like that,
I think it was AP,
coined the phrase that it was a flying saucer. I don't think Arnold originally said that.
Well, no, you're right.
Mr. Arnold.
Tommy, he's right.
Well, he is right. Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
Frank,
well, that ends that.
Let's all go home. That's one for me. I'm just marking it down.
May I just say this to you?
You guys aren't very serious, are you?
Let me tell you something. When did you speak with Mr. Arnold?
I never spoke with Mr.
Then how are you in a position to score this already?
Because I went through his file, which is a very thick file.
What do you mean?
Which quote found a Project Blue Book.
Kenneth Arnold's file?
Yes, I have a Xerox copy of it at home.
Well, I know Kenneth Arnold.
Okay.
That's better than you.
Hey,
I've had him on the show. That's better than you.
20 years
so
later.
So I'm going to score. All I can tell you is that Kenneth Arnold has said to me on my program, and I'll tell you the time when David Susskind was the Armstrong Circle Theater, I think was the name of the show, and Doug Edwards, I think, was the MC.
The Keyhole.
Yeah,
they cut him off the
air. And then there was a man, an astronomer, I forget, from Harvard.
Yes.
Came down.
Wasn't that Menzel?
I'm at a loss. I'm sorry, I can't say. And Kenneth Arnold, though, however, did not appear on the program, although he was in town. And at that time, I didn't know David Susskind. He didn't know me. In fact, his name didn't mean too much to me, and my name meant nothing to him. But he sent a telegram. I think you were associated with me in those days,
right,
if I'm not mistaken. He sent a telegram and said, be fair, and don't do anything till you call us to find out what actually took place. They had cue cards, which was not wrong, believe me, because, in other words, you've got to time a show. It isn't a free-swinging show like we're doing here. And on the cue cards, they told Kenneth Arnold what to say. And he didn't want to say that. And Kenneth Arnold, the next day, that afternoon, was on my program. We taped it. I mean, I didn't do an afternoon show in those days. And he described it as a flying saucer. This is what he claims. Now, maybe Kenneth Arnold is wrong, because I wasn't there 20 years ago when the statement was made.
No. All I'm saying is that... He made, I mean, his verbatim statements were recorded.
By whom?
By these Air Force investigators who interviewed him. And it's in the file at Project Blue Book, and this is what I waded through. It's a very thick file. All I was trying to say is, I'm not taking sides again. All I'm saying is that Kenneth Arnold was the man who started the whole business, really.
I just said that before you did. Yeah. But I'm glad that you agree. Score one for me. Was it not a whole check? Just a little dot there. You know what I mean? Because I don't want to get a whole score.
Big Town is turned on by the sound of Lee Leonard's voice. So is he. Weekdays at 1 on the Big Voice of Big Town USA, WNBC, New York.
And before we get back with our guests, I'd like to take a moment to talk about Chinese New Year. Say, if you're a little confused about some of the things we've been talking about so far, may I remind you that one of our guests, Mr. Stanton, who has really spent a lot of time investigating flying saucers, and he has written a book titled Flying Saucers, Hoax or Reality. He's going to be giving a lecture at the Hotel Woodstock. That's tonight, Friday night, 127 West 43rd Street, 7:30 p.m. And that is when the doors open. The lecture begins promptly at 8:30. And there'll be a question and answer period, and you'll have the chance to talk with him. Now back with our guests. We're talking this morning with Jerome Stanton, who's an electronics engineer, and he's been a science writer for many, many years, and he's responsible for the book titled Flying Saucers, Hoax or Reality. Lloyd Mallon is a science writer. He has contributed many articles to the magazine Science and Mechanics, and his newest book is titled, and Fred will at least be happy if I mention it,
right.
It's Safe to Smoke.
It is safe to smoke. Underline the is.
Well, I used it as a contraction.
Right.
It's safe to say. Were you offended?
No.
Turner. Because I didn't put the apostrophe in when I said
it. The publisher will be offended. I'm not. I wish he had
I
not even...
I care less if Fred is offended. Really, I won't lose a second sleep if Fred is offended. Karis Flamand is with us, writer and poet, who has written an article that appears in the current issue of Cavalier. The March 1967 issue, and there's a lot of contactee stories incorporated in his article, which is titled Flying Saucers and the Death of God. And we've invited Roy Schaff to be with us because Roy is not a believer, but certainly interested in these things. Roy, we'll give it back to you, and you might toss out a question.
Yes, I would like to say, before I go over to your gee whiz smoking business, you're not allowed to smoke, I want to ask some questions about that, but I'd like to talk about something that has probably given us something like a million more contactees, and that is, was it last night when a great fireball was seen from Alaska down the western coast until it hit somewhere on the western coast, until it finally, after it was called a UFO, very clearly over all the media, it finally was found out to be not a UFO, but a very clearly defined object that they knew about. It was a piece of a Russian satellite orbit, if not this satellite, that finally was affected enough by gravity to come out of its orbit and hit the Earth. We all have heard of it, haven't we? And so we're nodding our heads. Now, here we have people with an imagination looking up there, and we're all different, looking at a gorgeous, great, big, flashing thing coming down through the sky into our atmosphere. Now that we know about it, we can figure out what happened. Like a shooting star, a meteor comes through to the atmosphere, and because our atmosphere is thicker, it gets friction, it lights up. And so we can figure out why things have happened. And so people with an imagination say, hey, that, before we're told what it is, they tell us what they saw. And according to the kind of atmosphere around them, which might be thicker, more moisture, to make it disfigure the shape of it, to, you know, as it gets nearer to the Earth, to spread out and have a different kind of a shape.
Yeah.
By the time it gets to the ground, you've got at least a million people who might have seen it give you a million different stories. I'm saying this is the way you can get flying saucer contact these stories. Do you agree, Mr. Malheur?
I agree. Certainly.
I disagree with that entirely. Where's the contact here?
Well,
I think the story, by definition,
I agree,
no, was shaking hands with a Venusian.
That they saw flying saucer. Really, that I agree with that.
They saw UFO.
Yeah. They saw, and they may say they saw something that looked like so, because of the misshapen conditions that the atmosphere might give it. I'm sorry, you're quite right. The word contacting is wrong. However, the imagination, if the same great imaginations were went to work and assumed many other things, you might very well come out with little green men.
In point of fact, you see a UFO, some people, with the imagination you attribute to them, interpret it as being a flying saucer, and if they really have something they want to sell or have problems, it may land in their backyard and people step out of it.
I'd like to say one thing. You mentioned little green men. I've heard a tremendous number of contactee stories. I only vaguely remember hearing somebody talking about little green men, but no one that I've ever talked to ever saw these little green men. Most of the people that I've heard about are people of average height. If you could use something that would maybe a little different, golden eyes, and always had a spiritual look on their face. These are the type of fact, when Menger was the big man around town, Menger used to tell us that these men are working in gasoline stations and banks and places like that. You can't have little green men in banks, unless they're in the safe deposit box.
And little green bills, bro.
That's right.
George golden eyes.
That's right, working all over. So I've never heard these descriptions except once in a while somebody would say about somebody that was peculiar looking compared to what we thought that people looked like.
The only one I remember was the West Virginia. There was a West
the
Virginia
monster.
Site, but around that time there were
his whole family that shot
small people in the West Virginia.
The
only time.
These were described as little people about 3 feet high, but I think they were silvery, weren't they?
Was the German the one in Germany?
Apparently down in the was it West Virginia?
There was the little silver man that. Of which the photograph was taken, presumably, and published here and there, and accompanied by two men in raincoats who were frequently described as being FBI or Secret Service men flown over from the United States. And it's a fascinating photograph of a little man about 2.5 feet tall, and he's silver, obviously sort of iridescent. And two men a la Barker and the coats on either side and this little tiny figure holding the hands like, you know, Mama and Papa. But that's the only silver.
Well,
you
ever heard of Brazil, too, where these two fellows are supposed to be driving a truck.
Oh, yes.
These were about 3 feet high and
strong
and so on.
99%.
But you notice, gentlemen, in the flying saucers book that we have, not one little man is photographed. We do have.
Say, Frank Sasser, are you talking about the
Look magazine?
But there are a couple of photographs of little.
I'm sure there must be.
Not bad either.
I'm sure there's gold.
You know what I mean?
But along with this, the imagination has given us all kinds of ways of building stories, and I'm saying that we need massages once in a while. After all, life can become boring. When a great streaking light comes across the sky, we can add all kinds of things to it if we want to. I'd like to talk about your smoking now for a moment. You say it may be, these are your words, I'm not taking their words, I'm being kinder to you.
My words are it can be.
It can be, that's your, it can be safe to smoke.
Right.
Tell us a little about that.
Well, I'm awfully sorry, Mr. Schaffer. We did this just the other night.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We did the show with him. We might, a little later in the morning, we might get into this, but I think it would be unfair to Paris and to Jay, because, and even to Lloyd, because Lloyd is making a classical buck loading science and mechanics.
They don't pay that well, by the way.
Well, that's your problem. That's your hang-up.
They may not pay at all after that.
Well, I have another question then. It was mentioned before that 60, and I thought this was a very poor argument that you gave, extremely poor, 60 different craft must have been from different places outside our universe or somewhere. And isn't it possible that they can all come from one place?
Well, it's possible, but if this is so, then the people at that one place, for my money, are very poor engineers.
Why so? We all overlap. How many different craft do we have just that we sent to Vietnam?
Oh, now you're talking about military craft.
I'm sorry, sir, but you see, these can be easily...
All right, I can just quickly, without going into a lot of detail, tell you that among the high-performance aircraft, we're using four different types. One of them's almost obsolete. Among the reconnaissance-type aircraft, some of them overlap because, for example, the F-105, which is a single-seat fighter, also has a version for reconnaissance called the RF-105, which is a two-seater. This is equally true of the F-4C.
All right, now let me tell you something. The Russians have a few planes, too, and so do the other countries. And they're all different shapes. Would you agree?
No, they're not basically different shapes. They have to have an aerodynamic shape.
But they do look different. We can...
Not essentially. Only in terms of general configuration.
Kinds of helicopters alone,
of course.
Let alone...
All happen to have the type of airfoil system that keeps a helicopter up in the air, right?
But
a whirling... I mean, they have a whirling disc. I mean, it's a disc as a whirl.
But come, I think you're really trying to argue
There
are different airplanes, different ones from one planet called Earth. Right?
No, but these 58 to 60 different configurations were distinctly different. You look in the magazine there. There are drawings of them. I'm serious. No matter how many different versions of a helicopter there are, you can recognize it as a helicopter, right?
You're quite right.
And an airplane.
Let's qualify that a little. If you're reasonably sophisticated about our type of aircraft that fly by accelerating a mass of air downward, yes, you could say that's a helicopter and that's a helicopter, but supposing that you are an ignorant savage, we are supposed to presume, if we believe these stories about flying saucers being actually vehicles controlled by intelligent beings from somewhere else, that they are far superior to us in technology.
We might have an analog
here. We might be the savages who would not as readily recognize things as being, in fact, the same kind of vehicle as the savage in the center of New Guinea who might not be able to pick out one helicopter and say, well, that's essentially... generically, the same thing as that one over there.
Let alone seeing four or five different types of planes. I'm not even...
Mind you, I don't buy that for a minute, what I said there, but I'm just pointing out that this argument doesn't hold water too well.
It's very
poor. Well, I would think that even a savage who has no background in aerodynamics, if he saw three different designs of helicopter fly over the treetops and then saw three different high-performance jet airplanes fly over the same treetops, he would be able to distinguish the helicopter as such from the airplane as such.
Generally speaking, I would agree.
Unless he's really stupid, and I don't think savages are as stupid as the average intelligent human being.
Let's
so-called.
One point clear.
Just one point here, because it applies directly. There's no reason to believe that he would see a distinguishing characteristics, because native one sees either. Makes no difference which one of the craft.
Coming over to what I just...
A week later, native two sees it, and they say, we saw a great bird. And what great silver bird. Great silver bird in the air. Great silver bird moves fast. And
with
you can have all sorts of modifying characteristics.
Yeah, but
still,
I think you guys are simplifying this, because a high-performance jet fighter has a minimum speed at which it can operate. When it falls below, say, 150 knots, it's going to fall out of the sky. A helicopter travels much more slowly, makes a lot more noise, believe me, because a jet engine is directional in its noise.
No,
we're belaboring this point. Get out. Let's get to something else.
Well,
it's
but...
situation. All right. Well, I mean, we can go on and on saying...
Gentlemen, if you will, for a moment, don't overlap, please. It makes it difficult for our listeners. Mr. Mallon, if you'll listen to the question and then take, you know, plenty of time to answer it.
This blue book, I'd like you to tell me what it is first. I think the listeners, most of them must know, but some of them do not. What is the blue book?
Well, you mean very simply, because there's a complex history to it, as Stan can tell you. Project Blue Book began, I think, was it shortly after or just prior to Kenneth Arnold's...
it wasn't called Project Blue Book.
It was called...
There was a project started up by the Air Force in 1948 to investigate these reports that were coming in.
Incidentally, after Arnold.
Sign
Project Sign was the first name it had, and then it was changed to Project Grudge.
Tell
us what it is, please. We're overlapping terribly. I agree.
That's true, we are.
Yes,
Mr. Stanton, please explain what it is.
This thing actually was the Air Force's way of dealing with the reports that were persistently being sent in to local authorities like the police, who then bucked it up the line to the military authorities, about things being seen moving through the air that people on the ground were unable to identify as being something they knew about. Of course, whether or not they actually could be shown later to be something that was identifiable is another thing. The people who reported them were unable to say, well, we saw the 727 jetliner fly over last night at 5:43. They would just say, we saw something pass over there we couldn't explain. And the Air Force got enough of these reports in the few months following the first report from Arnold that they set up a project, that is a group of people specifically assigned to the duty of looking at these reports and trying to figure out whether or not there was anything here that was a threat to the security of the country that the Air Force naturally has.
That wouldn't be the first thing that they
write. That's the basic reason. That's project.
I think
now,
it's important
the first name for this group of people, the first code name which they assigned to it within the Air Force, was Project Sign.
This had only two people.
S-I-G-N. It started off with two people and a couple of clerks who shuffled papers and so on. But that's another thing. One of the reasons that I don't think that the Project Blue Book is now the name of this continuing function within the Air Force to analyze these reports. One of the things I am not notably impressed by is the fact that the size of the staff of people doing the work over the years has gone up and down like a yo-yo, depending on the immediate importance that was assigned to it within the Air Force, depending, you might say, on who happened to be in command at the time. And
it's never been, by any stretch of the imagination, a large group. It's always been
I think the biggest staff that Ruppelt had at the time of the biggest flap there, after that Washington duel,
52.
He had, I think, 11 people, counting himself.
Yes, at the most.
May I add something here without
overlapping? Part-time workers. Quite often, too. They weren't even fully assigned.
Yes, I would like to add something because this is often overlooked. The staff down at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which is headquarters for Project Blue Book, is small, except at their command, and they have no budget. They can call on anybody in the Foreign Technology Division of the Air Force Systems Command, which is the intelligence gathering section. And they can also call on anybody at any U.S. Air Force base in the entire world to act as an investigator.
They have the authority of the United States behind them.
Correct? That's right.
That's right.
So therefore, you can't merely look at the small staff down at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and say this is Project Blue Book, because it isn't, basically. Project Blue Book covers maybe, well, it could be as many as 5,000 investigators.
Well, I have a job here to find out your world with that.
I'm about to tell you now, if you'll give me a chance. Project Blue Book, the term, the code name, applies only to the people actually whose full-time job is they're officially assigned to analyze these reports. Now, the fact that they can get information from any Air Force base around the country doesn't enlist all the people who send them information as a part of the Project Blue Book team. This is something a guy might do in 15 minutes out of his whole day at some other Air Force
this
base.
This is not true. I hate to interject this, but it's not true. They can assign. They have the authority to call on any intelligence officer at any Air Force base, U.S. Air Force base.
You agree with that, Mr. Stanton?
No, I don't. That
well,
doesn't help. We have a
why can you disagree with facts? Wait a minute.
Everything you say isn't a fact automatically.
No, that's
the fact you say it.
The fact that I can ask, for instance, today I called up an editor at Aviation Week to get a phone number. That doesn't mean that he is part of my staff or whatever I would call it. My staff usually consists of me. The fact that I can call on somebody for information or ask him to look up something for me doesn't automatically put him under my command. That's exactly the situation that exists with the Project Blue Book. If they get a report from, well, now they can't order somebody out at another Air Force base, you go and investigate a saucer. They ask them for information.
No, no, they can order someone. They have the authority to
where
do this.
Just a moment.
You can check this out.
Hold it just a second. Where do you go? You tell us. You say you know. This is a fact.
Right.
Prove to us.
Where
right
did I
now.
Get the information?
Yes, I'd like to know.
I got it from Major Hector Quintanilla Jr., who was chief of Project Blue Book. I got it from Colonel George Freeman, who was the Pentagon liaison on this particular project. I got it from Colonel Maston Jacks, who is director of a whole section of the information section of the in the office of the Secretary of the Air Force.
And they all told you.
They all told
they
me.
All told
right.
That they have the authority to order people to give them information.
That's
is this
right.
True? Mr. Stanton, you disagree with them. I'd like to know why.
Well, they can ask for information from any place in the world, as far as I can make out. And I've talked to the same people that...
But they do have the backing of the U.S. government at the time. They can't,
I can make out. And I've talked to the same people that...
But they do have the backing of the U.S. government at the time. They can ask. Can
yes.
All right,
but that doesn't mean that the man at the other end of the pipe that they ask is under their command and has perforce to drop whatever else he's doing and go out in the field and look for something for them.
Oh, may I add this? At each base, there is an intelligence officer who is called the base UFO investigator.
And he has to go out and do the investigation as he's asked to do this by Blue Book.
Well, Paris, you're aware of all this, too. How would you vote on this?
Oh, I think it's ridiculous. It's like saying
how many hundred Air Force bases are there? If we go by that, then the Project Blue Book staff is going to be up in the hundreds.
More than the hundreds.
If Paris, I'll answer the question,
Roy. I'm asking Paris
if
a question. I'd like to
get past three or four words into the sentence before I'm interrupted. It's absurd for this reason. It's the equivalent would be to say that the medical staff of a hospital consisted of the operating staff, the surgical staff of a hospital, not all the interns and residents, but particularly the department that handled surgery, consisted of the surgeons,
yes,
plus the nurses, plus the attendants, plus the interns, plus the ambulance drivers, plus the attendants that went out in the ambulance, calls, plus anybody in the street who happened to call up when somebody got injured. Of course, anybody who collects information, almost I would say, I can't think of any exception offhand, would have access to information provided by innumerable people. Any writer finds this. He goes out and he may interview 100 people. These people have nothing to do with him directly, and yet all of them may respond if he calls. Now, if you want to put it in terms where the person has to respond, it's the State Department is in a position where it virtually can force a citizen anywhere in the world to, if it's absolutely essential for a national emergency. I mean, they could call upon a citizen and let's not name any country and get into complications, but any place in the world and say, look, your government needs you to do this, and 99 times out of 100, because the State Department or the CIA, whatever it was, the council, had the authority of the United States government behind them, they represented the country, they American citizen would say yes, if it was possible, he would accommodate them. And in these terms, of course, everybody is a member of the State Department. Everybody is a member of whatever you want them to be a member of. But Blue Book, as Dan has said, is specifically an organization, very small and never properly equipped or properly staffed, a group which was put together originally and still exists to not collect particularly, but to evaluate the reports from all over the world. They get reports, probably the majority of the reports don't come from service personnel at all. They come from all over the world, other governments, other military organizations, laymen and what have you, scientists, pilots. The purpose of this group is to collect and evaluate these.
I'd like to pick up the word evaluate. Pardon me for just a moment, Paris. The word evaluate immediately, I'm sure, would hit many listeners and say, well, when they evaluate, are they the scientists and engineers and mathematicians and physicists who are able to test and train? How do they evaluate?
Well, unfortunately, I think, pardon, that's one of the great drawbacks in all of the Air Force investigation, particularly, of course, in Blue Book. One would assume for evaluations of this sort, one would need precisely the kind of personnel which spoke, astronomers, astrophysicists, engineers, specialists in aerodynamics, radar specialists, and so on and so forth, and some really, I don't know how computers go in category, but at least a good computer.
I would say a computer, yes.
And point of fact that... Now, service amounts, well, they have access to these people. Of course they do. But why, with the kind of money we're spending all over the world for incredible things, we can't afford to have a top astronomer there at all times, a top astrophysicist there, or whatever is necessary, a staff of 100 people there, since this entire business has gone on for now a quarter of a century. We have no real answers for it. I don't happen to regard it as a probable threat, but then I'm sure that the day the bomb dropped on Hiroshima or Nagasaki, they didn't really think that a bomb coming over was a probable threat of annihilating the entire,
Appreciate your analogy, but
because one does not regard something as a probable threat doesn't mean that it isn't. I just think, and although it doesn't appear to me to be any great threat, because these things have been going on for a couple of thousand years.
May I say this, Paris and gentlemen, that if this magazine that Look put out called Flying Saucers, and they must have had a hell of a good group of people to check it, scientists, etc., or I don't know who they might have been, but really... It becomes an unimportant situation, and it would seem to me, I agree with you, Paris.
My argument is that it's a socio-psychological situation.
I would say that's true.
It's not a
And therefore, there in a so-called organization, which the Blue Book is supposed to be a product of, they would say, well, look, we're using an awful lot of energy for a thing that doesn't appear to be very dangerous at all. And so I would agree with you, Paris.
Back with our guest. We are talking with Lloyd Mallon, science writer, who's contributed many articles to the magazine Science and Mechanics. L. Jerome Stanton, who is the author of the book, which is available now in paperback, published by Belmont. It's titled Flying Saucers, Hoax or Reality. And then we have Paris Flamand, who for a number of years was associated with the show, and he is a writer and a poet. And I must say that his article, unfortunately, none of the other fellows around the table have had a chance to read the article in Cavalier.
Yes, I have.
Oh, you did read it?
I did see it.
Fine. Well, we'd hoped that we would have extra copies up here before the show, and we just didn't get them, but I think that Paris did an excellent job. It is certainly different from what Mr. Mallon has done and what Mr. Stanton has done, and this is not meant in a critical sense to Mr. Stanton or Mr. Mallon, because Paris has done it in a different way. He has brought us up to date with some of the contactee stories, and I've always been interested in the contactee stories because I think they're fabulous, especially if the guy tells a good one, and who knows, maybe he's telling the truth. Roy Schott is with us, photographer. You know, I was just down this afternoon. I took Gene Bolger, who is George Skinner's executive secretary. We went down to have coffee. And, gee, I must say, the way you rearranged everything down there, put a lot of...
We got Cromwell.
Yeah, Cromwell, the drugstore now that we put down there. And there's a great selection of pictures, not only of people that you hear on the shows that I do, but some of the people that you hear and see on the Johnny Carson show, and some of the great actors and actresses that I have never had the
is
pleasure of interviewing.
You and Paul Freeman?
Yes, that's great. Paul Freeman, the sculptor, who is with us many times, and that's been added to the group of photographs. So if you're around, you know, the RCA building, we hope that you'll stop in and go into Cromwell's Pharmacy. And, of course, don't go in there at high noon, you know, because they don't want you to be looking at Schott's pictures then. But go in, you know, when the action is not too great. And, gee, the photographs are just great. I know you'll enjoy seeing them because, you know, the names are there, and you'll see Sam Silver, Rabbi Silver, and Al Lottman, and Sina Hamilton, and Roberta Copper, and Anna Marie.
No, I didn't put her back yet. I took one down. I did not like one with the Derby. I got to put her back up again.
Roberta isn't down there now?
She's not down there.
Well, that's not
there. So I apologize.
Well, I know Anna Marie gets it.
Yes,
there. So take a look. You'll enjoy. Getting back with our guest. Again, I think what we should do, though, and you fellas haven't had a chance, and I have read the article, I would like to ask you, Paris, and really some of my questions are almost ridiculous for the simple reason that I could answer a lot of them myself, but you were associated with the show for a long while, and I think I'll ask you, what contactee story do you think was the one that sounded that it might be legitimate and yet far out? And tell the story. Tell, you know, what the guy or the gal actually said. Is there any particular one that you...
That's very hard. Actually, I'm not sure that the best one, best of the contactee storytellers was the one who told the most authentic sounding one, because I have a great weakness for Orfeo Angelucci's tales. I think he's probably...
You must listen.
Oh,
did I give you that?
I wanted to get, before I left this day, to get all the times up, but particularly, is this a new thing with Orfeo?
No.
Is it?
Well, you'll want to hear. It's the little girl.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, the little dancing
yes.
Girl. It is fantastic.
And that's only one of... it may be almost the best, but Scorpio, unlike other of the contactees, no matter how extravagant his claims were, you saw him sitting there, he's a little slight fellow, dark hair, he looks like a sketch by an Italian Renaissance painter or something, and he's so sincere. And some of the others, naming no one in particular, very
if I may interrupt,
smooth.
Is that a false sincerity? I
oh, no.
Really?
Yes.
Did Adamski make something of the same impression?
No.
No?
No.
I never met the man.
And there's
not
some that are...
Evangelism.
Yeah, and there's
no.
Some that come on, you know, it's outright cons, you know. No, I mean cons, and I won't identify which are which, but, I mean, you have the entire range from the... The ones who are obviously in it to make a fast buck from the suckers as fast as quickly as they can and then on to the next town, all the way through people that you kind of half believe but know they're kind of commercializing maybe something they halfway believe in, and then all the way over to
Angelucci. Well, we all
Angelucci,
know the best con is utter sincerity. That's why every con man has to believe in it.
But we're not that
you've
naive.
Missed something. No. You've missed something, Jay. I have done, I don't know how many, I was going to say hundreds, that's a sure exaggeration because there aren't hundreds to my knowledge, but say there at least 30 or 40 of them.
Yeah.
And when we're through, you know, we're through, great, when you're coming back in town next time, call me and we're going to put you out because it's good for me, it's great for the show, and it's good for the guy who wants to make the pitch. There's only one man, and I remember when he wrote me, went back to California, and when he sent me a letter, and I don't know if you can get the sincerity out of it that I did, he sent me a letter, and he thanked me for being out, and he said, I'm coming back, like in June, 2 months from now, and he said, I would like to have Paris and his wife and your wife be my guests at Toffanetti. That's another thing, but you know, it was so sincere,
it was
so lovely, so warm, that if he had come back at that time and if there was any opportunity for me to take the time, I would have marched over to Toffanetti's with him and sat there.
One of those rubber potatoes.
No, it's kind of a... He was that sincere, and when he would talk on the air, and when he would describe the little girl, which we're not going to do tonight because you can hear it Sunday, and when he would describe these things, I honestly believe, because, mind you, here is one guy that never made a buck. If he made a buck, if he ever made a fast $50 for giving a lecture someplace, he certainly must have spent $100.50 to get to the place to get the 50. He, when I would say about his book, it was Vanity Press, and I would say, where is the book available? You've got to give the guy a shake, right? He said, well, John, it's really not important. I said, well, I was in Bertano's, and I don't know if they were sold out, but I didn't see it there, see? You know, thinking, he'd say, well, a lot of people write in. Nothing, did he say. But John, it's just one of those things. He said, my book has not really been a very successful seller, and I really don't care. It's just I want to tell people about it. Well, you can't knock that. He's got you completely cornered.
So, in other words, he's willing to settle for the ego.
No, I think I'll go along with John for a while. I like to say
he believed everything he
Joan of Arc may very well have heard those voices.
Oh, I'm not...
I'm hanging around.
Of course you are. There's no doubt.
I'm not quarreling.
Now, look,
I think
every is that there are a lot of...
really believe when he comes back out of the desert.
There are a lot of sincere
philosophy that he heard the voices.
But the difference with Angelucci is that he had...
Would you go along with that?
Talk over too much. You don't listen. I'm sorry. You start talking, and then, of course, they should get the take.
I'm sorry. I tend to anticipate what you're going to say.
All right. Go ahead, Harris.
Well, just about Orpio, the thing that distinguished him from to those who, let's say, have visions, illusions, what have you, was and are totally sincere, was that he had a marvelous ability to convey his experiences. And when you read Orvio, it's not like reading most of the contactee stories. It's like reading Hans Christian Andersen. There's a gentle beauty about, and I don't mean he had great literary skill. He's not a, certainly doesn't have the kind of background we'd expect from somebody who would become a great, very story writer. But they have that quality. Unlike any other I've ever come across, he would, one incident where he meets Adam, who subsequently opens the entire horizons of the solar system and beyond, and his description of this physician from Seattle, Washington, and how he sat in the cafe late at night, and he, as a matter of fact, just to give a very brief sketch of it, he walks into the cafe one night, it's out in the desert, and he sees this figure in the booth, and I'm not going to do the bit, but around it, and he sees the fellow says, hello, Orfeo, and Orfeo speaking said, do you know me? Well, I expected you, Orfeo, and he does this dialogue, and it's just, and he sits down, and he talks about how he feels this, the beauty of this man, and he knew that his life had suddenly taken a turn that would develop and open enormous horizons for him, and he proceeds to talk about Adam in a way that eventually, I don't know if he, Adam is a, you know, right over somebody he knows or has known, but if he isn't, then Orvio has the ability to create a character that ranks with anybody you want to name, including Hemingway or...
If Orvio would have sold this book, not as a book based on fact, but as a fairy tale,
yes,
or fantasy,
right,
he would have, I'm not saying on the bestseller, but he would have made a classic.